Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, all theater lovers, both out and proud and on the DL, and welcome back to Broadway Breakdown, a podcast discussing the history and legacy of American theater's most exclusive address, Broadway. This series is called The Big Move, and it is covering shows that were so successful off-Broadway that they just had to transfer to the Great White Way and try some luck over there. I am your host, Matt Koplik, the least famous and most opinionated of all the Broadway podcast hosts, and with me today is a returning guest. You last heard him on the Caroline und Change episode, and he is a playwright, he is a reporter, journalist. You can see his articles all over different magazines and websites. When we last recorded, you were working on an opera. Is that correct?
Yes. It was Fidelio. It was with Heartbeat Opera, and we did it at the Met.
Yes, you sure did. Please welcome back Mr. Marcus Scott. Miss Scott, if you're nasty.
Thank you.
Welcome, Marcus. How are you?
I'm good. It's, you know, it's Sunday. We're thriving.
You look very cozy with your sweatshirt and with your hood up. I'm like, that is the way to be.
That's also because my hair needs to be cut.
Oh no.
It's a nice, like, my hair is free. I just afro picked it out, so we're good.
amazing. I just got my hair cut recently, humble brag, and it is not hiding under any hoodies or hats or onesies today. Marcus, what show are we discussing today?
We are discussing one of my favorite shows, Passing Strange by Stu.
Mm-hmm. And Heidi Rodewald.
Yes, Stu and Heidi. They are a brilliant group of people.
Yes. What is your history with Passing Strange?
So I was attending NYU. I went to the Graduate Musical Theater Writing Program. I do not have technical training as a playwright. I became a playwright out of necessity. We'll have a conversation about that later. But I was there, and I was introduced to the musical by a good friend of mine, Max Vernon, who wrote The View Upstairs and other shows. And
was Coleman Domingo in The View Upstairs? Am I making that up?
No, you're making that up. But Coleman Domingo did Dot. Which
there it is.
Which is around the same time, yeah, as The View Upstairs. And but yeah, because what I love about that show and how I got into that show was Max introduced me after being in grad school, being around a bunch of people who basically told me that musical theater had a particular sound had a particular way of being seen. And Max was like, well, Marcus, I really feel like you would really enjoy this show. And so I said, oh, okay, let me go see it. And so they had just like released the film. And because I wanted to see it live, I heard about it, but I never got to see it. And so I saw the film and I wound up, that kind of, that was like the show that kind of really cracked me open as a musical theater writer. I saw that right before I wrote my thesis show, Cherry Bomb. And it's kind of like homing missile, if you will, for my creative instincts. It has everything you want in the show. It's smart, it's creative, it's poetic. There is an effervescence to it. It's the perfect show.
It's also very funny, guys. For anyone who's like, oh, this might be too heady for me. And don't you worry, it's dense and it can make you feel like a dum-dum. It is also very, very funny. My introduction to the show, Marcus, is when I was a junior in high school. No, senior. No, junior in high school. Mm-hmm. I was a part of this amateur teen, like, critics class, seminar, curriculum, whatever. There used to be this company and program that did, like, discounted tickets for students before TodayTix was a thing, before TDF was a thing. It was, you know, you had to be a member, you had to, you know, pay like a $10 fee or whatever. And then they would have certain, you know, discounted tickets available. And they weren't always like fancy stuff. It was off Broadway, on Broadway, whatever. But they started doing this like teen critic curriculum. And we would get together like every 2 to 3 weeks. And we would often, you know, get sent out to see shows, and then we would come back and we'd have to write stuff and share it with everybody. And our teacher was Aisa Davis, who plays Mother in Passing Strange, and she was rehearsing Passing Strange for the public at the time, and we often had our meetings at the public. And I remember we got to sit in on one of their rehearsals. It was for Mom's Song, when they were doing that This Is Your Life. I remember it very clearly. It was in like one of their main rehearsal rooms, the one that like looks like a giant like loft hallway with all the columns, you know? And I thought it was so cool. I had no idea what I was watching. First of all, without the context of everything around it, it definitely was a number we were all like, this is really cool. What's happening plot-wise? And she was like, too hard to explain. And then we were invited to go see it at the public, and I opted out of it because Spring Awakening was doing their first open call for teenagers, and 17-year-old me was like, this is my chance to become a star. In my defense, I did get called back twice from that open call. However, I did miss Passing Strange at the public. So when it transferred to Broadway, I was no longer part of the teen critics group. So I paid my own damn ticket to see it on Broadway. I contributed to their grosses. So I made up for my faux pas in 2007, in March of 2008. And I super fell in love with it. It was what I was really gunning for the Tonys that year. I was devastated when they didn't even get nominated for director. I remember seeing the lack of directing nomination. I was like, excuse me? How is it that Annie did not get nominated? That staging and that direction is flawless. And then I remember it closed while I was at summer camp, and the news came out that Spike Lee was going to film it. And I was very excited, and I could share it with others after that. So that is my history with Passing Strange. And then I probably come back to it every like 2 years, I would say. And I give it a nice re-listen.
Same. It's one of the shows where I watch it to study it. And just because to me, it's one of those shows where I remember the last time before watching it recently, I cried because I was like, oh my God, I'll never be able to write like this. it's a pivotal show, and the influence it's had on musical theater since is extraordinary.
Yeah, it's an interesting time that it comes out and what it does and how it and the impact it's had. And we'll get into all this as we sort of, you know, discuss the whole thing. As you know, Marcus, structure has gone out the window with this show. That's actually one of the major influences that Passing Strangers had on this podcast. Is I said, fuck structure. Act one, act two, act three, out the window. I do have like a list now. I give myself a checklist of things that I want to cover as you go through the episodes We will discuss all of this good shit. Oh, before I forget, guys, we actually have a couple of reviews. I want to get them out of the way. Since we famously now launched on Broadway Podcast Network, we have had two episodes come out since recording this. And I just want to quickly say before I read these reviews, because three of them deal with the same technical issue, because I am essentially a one-man band with this podcast, and I am not a technical person, and I have to always lean into however I can record with different guests, my recording equipment changes sometimes episode to episode. So for the first episode of this series, which was Rent, with our recurring guest Adam Ellsbury, Gunkle of the Pod, we were using microphones that we hadn't used in like over a year, and they were not set properly, and Adam was too far away from his mic. So it was a quiet volume episode. It was not impossible to hear, but I did have a couple of people reach out and be like, I can't listen to this on the subway. I'm like, yeah, you'll have to listen to it at home, like quietly at home. Like, you can't be cooking while you listen to it or loading the dishwasher. But so we've gotten some new reviews, and I'm saying this now because a couple of them mentioned the sound. So just clench your teeth, y'all. And we'll get through them, but they are nice reviews. So, cue the Light in the Piazza overture music. 5 stars. Absolutely incredible. So good. So interesting. I love the current series on Sondheim. That is not current anymore. Matt is beyond knowledgeable and even more opinionated, which makes for a great show every week. The episodes are always very low volume. Can you bump that up a little? They're not all low volume, just like 4 of them are. I'm just telling everyone. Next one. Great podcast, 5 stars. I very much enjoy this show. It's absolutely wonderful on long car rides, because my episodes are 9 hours long, which I take a lot to visit my parents. That's nice. However, since the switch to VPN, the sound is very low. When I turn it up all the way in my car, I can barely hear it against the sounds of the road. Other than that new issue, keep up the good work. You've got a loyal listener in me. 5 stars. This one is right to the point. Headline is, what is up with the sound? I'm gonna rave about this show because the theater nerd in me loves it. The hosts are like your best friends, sharing insight and critical, thoughtful presentations that flesh out and envelop the shows they speak about. So here is the but, guys. Now that you have ads, the problem with the sound is even more glaring. I'll listen to podcasts while doing other things. Never had a problem hearing all of them, but each episode of the show feels like the hosts have turned down their mics. The only way to listen to it is make sure there is no outside sound that prevents hearing the show. Ads are at regular volume. One moment I can barely hear, and then suddenly a full volume out of my ears. I absolutely understand that. I can't control the volume of the ads. I can only try to make the episodes themselves louder. I'm gonna do my best, y'all. I hope they fix this issue, because I'd love to listen as I'm doing chores around the house, but even a running faucet to dishes makes it impossible. But once again, I do love the show. Thank you. I know. Stop running your faucet while you're listening to me. Cut out everything and just listen to me. That is what God is telling all of you. Shut off the lights, tune out the world, and just listen to my sultry, sultry voice. Next one, 5 stars. Safe space for conflicting feelings. I just discovered this podcast, and I knew I was in the right place about an hour into the Rent episode. Rent has, and probably always will be, because nostalgia, my favorite musical. But revisiting at the age of 25 has been a complicated experience, because now I see and understand the issues many people have with it. I will probably defend it until the day I die, so it is sometimes hard to hear the valid criticisms. But Matt and Adam did it in such a positive, thought-provoking, funny way. I can't wait to listen to more episodes. But for now, the thought of Collins hopefully redeeming himself by being a safe sex advocate will live in my head rent-free until the end of time, and really did not mean to do that as a pun. Thank you. And finally, the last one, 5 stars, informative and entertaining. Now, I've just learned of this podcast, and I've already listened to 6 episodes. That is like a 2-week process, listening to 6 episodes of this podcast. I really appreciate getting both well-supported points of view and saucy personal insights. I'm now subscribed because I need more and more. Thank you. So, Marcus, no pressure, but the pressure is on for information, saucy opinions, and entertainment. Be funny. Now, go. Okay.
I can't
tell a joke, Marcus, now.
I'm a writer. It comes to me when I'm writing, not when I'm speaking.
Well, so you mentioned earlier when you come back to the show all the time, like you kind of just go, I can't touch this. Like, this, like, the writing is just so good. There are some works that inspire me to write, and then some works where I'm like, it's so good, I'm paralyzed and I can't write. The last time that happened to me was when I first saw Strange Loop at Playwrights Horizons. Afterwards, I was like, so I'm not touching a computer for like 3 weeks, because this is going to live in my head. And then before that was the second season of Fleabag. Anytime I watch the second season of Fleabag, I can't write for like days.
So here's the thing. I have yet to watch Fleabag. I know. It's like a cardinal sin. I feel like it's like the one show that everyone's like, you need to watch Fleabag. But in terms of Strange Loop, I have interviewed Michael a couple of times. And also, that it's really interesting that you mentioned a Strange Loop, because a Strange Loop is very much a show or a product that has been influenced deeply by Passing Strange, and not just like structure wise but just like the themes in it as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. First of all, you don't need to do a goddamn thing, Marcus. You can watch whatever it is you want to watch. You don't worry your pretty little head with what society tells you to watch. I do think you would like Fleabag, and I think the first season is incredible. The second season is just a masterpiece, in my humble opinion, and perfect. And every time I watch it, I'm like, no, I can't do that. But you're right. A show like A Strange Loop, I mean, I haven't interviewed Michael like you have, so I can't officially say it myself, but there are so many parallels, and there is so much influence that Passing Strange has had. It's like a trickle effect throughout writing in musical theater, and it's very fun to see. For those who are unfamiliar with The Strange of Passing, what is it about?
It is about a character named Youth. That's all the character's name is in the show, who lives in Los Angeles and in the suburbs. In the 70s, 1976, with his mother, his single mother, and they attend churches, and their life let me take it back. I'm like, I was trying to like elevator pitch it. I was like, that's not how you do it.
Picture it. Sicily, 1922.
Passing Strange takes place in 1976. It follows the youth and his journey through the first 25 years of his life as he goes from Los Angeles to Amsterdam and Berlin in his conquest or search rather to be an artist. That's what Passing Strange is about. And I tried to do that within a sentence.
Yeah. I mean, that is very much at its core, like the gist of the show. Yeah. Youth is an African-American youth in Los Angeles in the 70s. And yeah, he wants to be an artist. He wants to find what he calls the real and is just always in search of it. And there is another character we must discuss, which is the narrator, who is essentially Stu. Yeah. And he narrates everything, but also you come to realize that it is his life story. Not Stu himself, necessarily. He has said that the show is not necessarily autobiographical. There's a lot of it that is from his own life, but it's not like
self-referential. It's very much, it's again, a Strange Loop.
Yeah.
Like in that wheelhouse. It's his story, more or less, bits and pieces taken from his life. And you come to find out that it's a memory show.
Yeah.
He's telling a show from the future.
Yes. In the form of a rock concert, theatrically staged performance piece.
Yeah.
And
a story.
Yeah, it's a coming of age story, and then also there are so many themes about this show that I love, that I think they do so well. The connections of, you know, parent and child, and embracing, you know, your culture and your legacy and what you're capable of, but also where you come from, and there's a difference between reinventing yourself and lying about who you are, which is something that Youth keeps on gaslighting people about in Act Two, where he's like, I'm not lying. It's like, this is how I feel. It's like, no, dude, you're not from the projects. You come from an upper middle class home in the suburbs. it's really fantastic. Something that's actually interesting about Passing Strange, now that I'm thinking about this, because I talked about this with Adam in Rent.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming, Marcus, you have familiarity with Rent.
Of course. It was like a gateway musical for like everybody in like growing up in the 2000s.
Exactly. Whether we all are willing to admit it or not, we all had Rent as a moment for us. And like my iTunes review said, you know, there is a nostalgic connection we all still have with it. And there's a lot about Rent that is still fantastic objectively, but there's a lot of other stuff that you look at with older, wiser eyes and you go, And one of the things that I think Passing Strange does so well that I think Rent missed the boat on is the bravery of youth wanting to be an artist and being bad at it. Like he's smart, he's passionate, he's insightful. He's just bad at making art. And once he gets to Europe and he continues doing it, like he's still like he gets older, he doesn't get much better. He gets better at impersonating other people's art, but he's not actually good. He basically goes from like being a teenage Mark Cohen to being a faux European Maureen, is how I best would describe youth's like artistic journey.
That's hilarious. Yeah, no, I would argue that he does become good, but it's really not until the last song.
Really thought of that last song as like his work. I guess that's sort of the blurring of the lines of everything. I always just looked at that as like an actual musical moment in like his life, not him creating something. But I guess you're right. That's sort of where the lines get blurred and passing straight.
But that's also like that's literally like where the concept of that's where the show becomes cyclical, because it's him writing Passing Strange.
Yes, and he becomes a good artist because the narrator has put up this very good show for us. Yeah. But youth in the moment of the show is not very good at the art.
Ladies and jerks, we are the Stereotypes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm at war with Negro Morris. I'm at war with ghetto norms. My mother stands in doorways making me to conform. Be a good football player, snazzy dress and brother. So the sisters won't be able to tell me from the others. Yeah,
it is good at code switching, which, you know, the show does a lot of.
Yeah. Well, so that's one of the themes of the title, right? Is, you know, the title has a lot of meaning to it. Mm-hmm. It's first taken from a line from Othello. Mm-hmm. What's the actual line? I have it written down. I thought of something along the lines of like, she swore in faith was strange, 'twas passing strange, something like that.
Yes.
And passing strange in the context of Shakespeare means extremely strange, mm-hmm. which Stu has said, you know, yeah, you can absolutely take that at face value. You know, this extremely strange feeling of just sort of being alive. And then adolescence being a passing phase, mm-hmm. passing in a white culture as a black man. And then what is it that Rebecca Naomi Jones says to him in Berlin?
She says passing for ghetto, but in the Arlington Hill song, it's black people passing for black people.
Yes.
The pastor's son says that.
Yes. And the pastor's son says that after the Edwina Williams moment, when youth mm-hmm. is at church for the first time in years, and Edwina says to him that he's has to be blacker if he's going to get with her.
Yeah.
Black it up a bit. Yeah. And what I also love is that it's a small ensemble of actors, right? And everyone but Daniel Breaker and Aisa Davis played multiple roles. So we have Rebecca Naomi Jones, how do you pronounce her name? Deirdre Azizza?
Yeah, Deirdre Azizza.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Coleman Domingo. And then who's the fourth actor?
Oh my gosh. His name is Rodney Roderick.
Chad Goodridge?
That's his name.
Yep, that's his name.
That's his name.
Roderick. I want to say Bethany.
I was like, that's not his name.
first of all, has abs you could wash your clothes on.
My God. I mean, like, where did he go? He just kind of disappeared.
He's really the only one from that company that hasn't really continued. Yeah. So this cast, you know, Daniel Breaker goes straight from this into, unfortunately, Trek. But you know, has continued to have a really strong career. Rebecca Naomi Jones, we've seen in a million things. That's been wonderful. Yeah. Deirdre, you know, she's around. She's done stuff.
She's gone to TV. Like, yeah. I mean, like.
And then Coleman just keeps on dominating. Like
Coleman has done, I mean, Broadway, he just won an Emmy for his guest star or supporting mm-hmm. star for Euphoria. Rebecca Naomi Jones has become basically like the first lady of rock musicals. She's done everything, like mm-hmm. Wicked. She did Hedwig. She's done.
She did American Idiot.
American Idiot, which I saw right after she left Passing Strange.
Same. When I saw my two big takeaways when I saw American Idiot, because all the Spring Awakening kids, all the guilty ones, went and see it, and they're like John Gallagher Jr. And I went in, gay me. And I saw Stark Sands and I was like, it's Die Mommy Die. And then I saw Rebecca Naomi Jones. I'm like, it's Passing Strange. And everyone was like, you're a homosexual. And I'm like, I know. Leave me alone.
No, I remember watching that particular show and walking out and being like, Well, the show was something, but she was great. She was
phenomenal. American Idiot. Yeah. I liked American Idiot. I liked Passing Strange more.
Yes. But
my two takeaways from American Idiot were, I did not know Stark Sands could sing. And I went, well, he can just do anything he wants to me now.
I mean,
and because not only is he a great actor and very dreamy, now he also sings like a damn angel. And then it was my first time seeing a Stephen Hoggett choreographed show. And I thought his choreography was really exceptional. And Rebecca was amazing, but I knew she was amazing because I had seen Passing Strange. And then she replaced for the Broadway company of Significant Other, which is another show we'll be talking about at some point on this podcast. Don't you worry, Marcus.
I would love to hear it. Your thoughts about it.
I think you can imagine what my thoughts are mm-hmm. on it. I never felt more personally attacked or have my privacy more violated than when someone hacked my social media and made a play out of what they found. And just threw it on stage. And they said, we're going to do one thing. We're going to change the name of the main character from Matt to Jordan and call it a day.
Joshua Harmon.
But we're not talking about him. We are talking about Rebecca Naomi Jones and then Passing Strange. But
yes.
So we got off track, which is
yeah, the track. But yeah, no, we're talking about, just everybody from that particular show has become like stars. Everybody.
Yeah.
Deidre Aziza has become a TV star. Aisha Davis has, she was nominated for Pulitzer like a year after Passing Strange. Yeah.
Aisha is an actress and a playwright, in addition to being a wonderful critics teacher, I must say. She I remember her being very nice to me. But yeah, she's written plays and Pulitzer nominated. She's also done a lot of TV. For a hot second, she was Angelica Houston's lawyer on Smash. I'm sure you remember.
Yes. Of course. Who hasn't watched Smash or hate watched Smash? If you depending yes. on which camp you are in.
Yes, we love Smash when Megan Hilty gets a number, and we hate it when everyone talks.
Yeah, no, the dialogue was. I think it's hilarious that they really tried to convince us that like it was actually competition between Ivy and like.
That's Walter. Yeah. Well, so that's the problem when you make a whole first season before it starts to air and you don't check out social media or anything like that. So you build this whole first season, it's like building Karen to, be the star that they're hinting she's going to be. Meanwhile, it's airing and everyone's going, clearly Megan Hilty. And so they had to do course correction for season two. Be like, no, yeah, you guys were right. We shat the bed on that one. You know who wouldn't have made that mistake is Stu. If Stu were in charge of creating Smash, he'd be like, clearly Megan Hilty. And we'd be like, yes, thank you, Stu. You know what Stu's first musical he ever saw was?
What? Which one?
How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
Really?
According to his interview on Theater Talk with shithead Michael Riedel, he talked about, he's like, I knew of musical theater. I think he had seen probably a couple like movie musicals. Because living in, first of all, LA, theatrical wasteland, especially when he was growing up.
Yeah.
And he said his first musical, I believe Heidi Rodewald took him to see, because she joined his band around 2000, I want to say 2001, because they were sort of indie rock underground cult figures. Yeah. They were successful in the sense that they had a core audience and they were always working, and he was, I think, Grammy nominated at that point too.
Yeah.
But they were not huge rock stars
by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. What?
I said, by any stretch of the imagination.
No, not whatsoever. But he says that she took him to his first musical, which was How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And Michael Riedel's like, well, what was that like? Thinking, Stu's going to be like, I said, fuck this. But Stu was like, no, it was great. He's like, it was a wonderful musical. He's like, it was what he said was he had never seen songs done that way, where it wasn't just about expressing one feeling or setting an atmosphere. It was about legitimately telling a story through a song or a variety of emotions in one song and having that song then connect to another song later. He's like, I thought that was really cool. I'm like, yes, too. That's musical theater.
I love it.
But then he got exposed to more, because the interview was all about, you know, they had opened on Broadway and it was, you know, it's like the anti-musical. They talked about it, like the way they kept trying to advertise it was the musical for people who didn't like musicals. And rereading the New York Times review, Charles Isherwood, who I also don't like very much, but he was on the money in this one. He's like, don't call it a musical. You'll scare off the people that are going to like it. I'm like, it is a musical, though. It's just absolutely like the it's a variety of genre. It's not solely rock. They use a whole lot of different musical influences. And it is a straightforward story. It's just done in a sort of abstract-y way. So, sorry, I'm grabbing the steering wheel for like 5 more seconds, and then I'm going to hand it back over to you.
Go for it.
Thank you, Marcus. I thank you for allowing me to take the wheel on my podcast, where I invited you, and then I said, you stop talking now. So this came out in between seasons of Spring Awakening and Next to Normal, and I feel like that trifecta of rock music has been very influential on the Broadway scene, all three in various degrees of success in different ways. I would argue, and I'll talk about this more in depth when I talk about Next to Normal and Spring Awakening in their episodes, but Spring Awakening is, in my opinion, a rather straightforward story that uses songs in a non-musical theater sense. The songs will sometimes talk about an emotional state, but they're more kind of like commentary songs in the way that like the songs in Cabaret can be commentary songs. They're not diegetic. They don't sort of flow freely from the dialogue. Whereas I would argue Passing Strange does do that with its score, but the show is told not in as straightforward a way. It's, you know, when you tell what it's about, as you did, like, it's, you think, oh yeah, sounds like a pretty simple story I can follow. It's like, no, they do not present it that straightforward. But the way that the music is used is in a very traditional musical theatery way. And then we have Next to Normal after this, which is a story told very straightforward with a rock score that is done in a very musical theater sense of like flowing from dialogue and telling about an emotion, and there's a beginning, middle, and end. And I think there's probably a reason why Spring Awakening and Next to Normal, outside of, you know, the other obvious systematic problems with the Broadway scene, but the idea of sort of what can be more swallowable in terms of how to tell a story, despite audiences always saying we want new things, when you actually give them something that's slightly off from what they know, they're always like, can you take 2 steps back? And that is sort of where I never thought I would say like that Next to Normal is palatable, but I this is where we're at now, where I'm looking at it going like, what a palatable show about a woman who's losing her mind over her dead baby from 18 years ago. But like, do you know what I mean? Just like in terms of like objective storytelling of the three, Passing Strange is the one that's a little more like, no, you have to do a little bit of work if you want to like ride this wave. It's not so dense that it's impenetrable, but it is like, we expect you to at least like sit on the edge of your seat and listen and like use the remaining brain cells you have.
Which
I really admire. That's all I want to say. I want you to now take the wheel. Tell me something.
I think that I wanted to hit on a couple of things that you mentioned, which like the show fuses, like musically, it fuses gospel, it fuses jazz, it fuses punk rock, it fuses blues, and it
Europop.
Some Europop, yes, as well.
Don't you dare deny the Merci Beaucoup track where he flies to Amsterdam. That is my favorite jam in the whole show.
True. And it also does like alternative, I would say like downtown cabaret music as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I feel that like what it did, and I feel like it is very influential on especially contemporary musical theater for a reason. And I'll tell you that in a moment. But I think that like looking at the time period, like that kind of like that Spring Awakening, Passing Strange, Next to Normal, what it did was that it if we're going to talk systemically, other than like just it being like talking about race and Black people being on stage and playing Europeans and so forth and so on, it's a show that I would argue the Black, even though like the musical theater, a lot of it benefits from Black expression and Black sounds. Taking rock and roll like that, blues rock like that, it was ahead of its time. Taking, you know, putting that kind of that sound on stage and it not having that kind of alternative rock kind of like Jonathan Larson sound that everyone had been, you know, so familiar with for 12 years at that point. It was a very, you know.
Marcus saying that Jonathan Larson sound got me real good because you just know exactly what he's talking about.
But you know what I'm talking about.
That's right. I absolutely know what you're talking about.
And so, like, what this was, it took you back to, like, Lead Belly, and it took you back to Muddy Water sounds that, like, while they were influential on, like, the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and all the music that, like, would later influence, like, a Jonathan Larson, that those sounds had not really crossed over, really, into the pop stratosphere, and so, or into the zeitgeist, if you will. And so what this was doing was kind of like taking back rock and roll, I would argue, and saying, like, this is what we are. And it also, because of, like, what people were used to on Broadway, you know, of course off Broadway, with, like, how Black sounded like on stage, usually it's, you know, it's doo-wop, it's, you know, Little Shop of Horrors, or it's Motown, it's, you know, or it's Dreamgirls, you know, you weren't really influenced by that, you weren't really hearing that. And so why the show was, and I would argue very much like Strange Loop, that show musically, what it's doing and what both shows have done is challenge how Black sounds like on stage. And some of these, with A Strange Loop, one would argue that it's, you know, it's a Black man, or, you know, writing music that sounds like Lilith Fair, you know.
Yeah.
This right here was, this right here was taking a sound that was kind of like Chitlin Circuit music and putting it on stage, and, you know, and doing it in a way that honored rock legends past and present. And so I think that Passing Strange, one day it'll get the kind of like love that it needs, but right now it's still in that kind of that liminal space musically.
It's in a niche space right now. What's actually given it a lot more exposure, of course, is the Spike Lee documentation of the last three performances. That's which, right, I'm grateful for. And it is, in my opinion, probably the best filmed stage performance
ever.
I was gonna say it battles out with Into the Woods, but the thing about the Into the Woods recording is, like, that is not very inventively cinematically filmed. It's just, exactly, it's a documentation of a perfect cast, Into the Woods. So that's what that is. But like, they don't make it like this really exciting movie. They're just like, we're going to make this not seem like a Lincoln Center archival recording and give you like four camera angles. Whereas Spike Lee really like gets in there and makes you feel, because that's the thing about a lot of filmed theatrical works is it's really difficult sometimes to capture the energy that you can get in a theater. And that show in particular, there was, it sounds weird to say heat, because like that, the score runs hot and cold because of sort of the emotions that run throughout it, right? Like once he gets to Berlin, it like, it goes straight from, you know, beautifully warm waters to ice cold that just like shocks your skin. But there is sort of like an aromatic sense about the music. It's just like it fills the air and you just, it envelops you completely, and you really can't capture that in a movie, especially if it's, you know, of a stage show. You're not making it its own cinematic thing. But I think Spike Lee does, or if not does to some people, gets as close as anyone could to any doubters out there.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
But yeah, no, it's still a niche show for sure. Part of it is, you know, I can only comment objectively as a musical theater fan. I can't really comment on the systematic racial elements because that is not something that I am.
Oh, we can get into it.
No, you can get into it. I want to hear you talk about it. I'm saying I'm not going to talk about it because what the fuck do I know? I can only talk about what I've read, what I've heard. I become a parrot, and I'm a beautiful parrot, Marcus, but I don't want, that's not what this podcast is. I want to hear your take on this, but I will say I'm going to go from like the basic musical theater standpoint of things that do hurt shows sometimes, not just Passing Strange, but shows like Passing Strange, mm-hmm. which is that like, and this is a surface shallow level stuff. And then we'll get into surface level shallow stuff. I'm sorry. I had a stroke, but,
understood.
But there's no real number in Passing Strange that one could do like an audition cut for, could do in a cabaret setting, which I love about that score. Like some of my favorite scores are the ones where I'm like, you can't do any cut from it. Cause it's so, it's part of such a whole, It's what I love about the Great Comet score. Like, people try to sing No One Else in cabaret spaces. I'm like, yeah, you did a great job. It only works in the show. Or people try to do songs from like Lacuse's Wild Party. I'm like, no, I'll listen to anyone sing When It Ends or Uptown.
Love that score. Love the song. You can't do it outside the show.
Exactly. Like, it just it doesn't work as well. And I mean, not even as well. Like, you just do it and you're like, yeah, I watched you be talented, but that song does not fit outside of the tapestry that it's woven into. And that is something I just adore about Passing Strange. I wasn't joking, by the way, when I said that Merci Beaucoup is my favorite track, because it's not much of a song, but it's just such a vibe. It's just, there's something up, and it's like the only song in the score that's like it. Yeah. And it's not that it's the deepest song in the score. It's not that it's the most intelligent. It's just the fact that like every time it comes on, I immediately get into like Brigitte Bardot, like 60s go-go, like I just start to feel very cute and very sexy, and like you just walk down the street going la 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 la. Again, simpleton me also loves songs like We Just Had Sex for the like pure comedy of it. It's also fucking brilliant lyrics.
Yeah, no, I love that particular. I love also just the way it's staged. Mm-hmm. You know, it's brilliant. But probably my favorite song is probably just because I've been there. I was the youth. Mm-hmm. So much of my story and so many people I know, their story is the story of the youth. But it's Baptist Show, Baptist Fashion Show.
Yeah,
probably one of my favorite songs.
Baptist Fashion Show. That's also a vibe. That music.
That's a whole vibe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's also like its own mini play, that whole section. Is it even going into the Blues Revelation stuff, or is it just the first part of it?
I would say the whole thing, like start to finish. I just think that it's the perfect song. It also just gives you what I think it does perfectly well is that it captures Kojic Black church culture like the politics of it, the kind of the gestures, the language, all of it is in that song.
The showmanship of it too, right? And sort of to see and be seen.
The one-upsmanship. Yeah, it's all in that. And it captured it in such a poetic way. Mm-hmm. And also in a very funny way. And also like that, yeah, you know, like that feeling. The story of it, it's a one-act musical in a song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would say it's a 10-minute show within a song. Now it's gone real. Now it's real. Can you deal with the real? Hit me with the Holy Ghost. The bubble was expanding. There was a new understanding. Music is a great train in which God travels. Bang, it doesn't sink, and then my soul unravels. Feels like holy water. What it does so well is that it captures not only the 1970s, but it also captures kind of like this post Clark Sisters like gospel sound that is really just evocative of the time.
Mm. It's also, I mean, and from a dramatic storytelling point, it's the inciting incident of Youth's journey. It's when he connects to music in a way that will launch him for the rest of the show.
Is it the I Want song?
How dare you assume that Passing Stranger would perform to an I Want song? His want is just to find the real. So anytime anyone says the real, that is the I Want song and the reprise. When Rebecca Naomi Jones says nonstop to the real, I'm like, that's the reprise of the I Want song. Right when it was starting to feel real. I love that too. The whole Amsterdam section, I think, is a masterpiece.
I was going to say, It's All Right is probably, we're talking about just joy, then It's All Right is probably my favorite song.
Yeah, Keys, It's All Right is one of those numbers. That was probably the first time I experienced in a theater an audience and cast energy that was just sort of blended. We're now in a culture where audiences really want the actors to know that they're there. Mm-hmm. And so they will woo, they will scream. This has been discussed a lot with Miss Michelle Curley in Funny Girl, who is great in the show, but the audience reactions are stupid. Like, she knows you're there. She can see all of you out there. You don't have to shout when she hits a note. Let Mama finish the song. But before this time, when we all became awful, this was the first time I had been in a theater where the audience was just so jazzed about the vibes going on and Stu's energy, and then also just the writing of it, of the continuation of the list. Josephine Baker says, "All right, James Baldwin," and because it just keeps going and going, and it's we're now, once we get to Europe, that we finally get the back wall of all the neon lights, so there's all this flood of color on stage, and it's this energy that just everyone just like started singing back, and everyone got up from their seats, and this was like a half full house in the middle of March at the Belasco Theater, and no one did it to be like special or the one. Everyone was just so fucking jazzed, and it was a really beautiful moment to have, which is why I was so glad that they did it on the Tonys, but also I was like, they should just do the whole sequence, because doing the 8-minute sequence in 3 minutes,
it makes sense.
Yeah, just changes it. They did their best, and they were able to get to a good energy there, but it was like, you really need the full 8 minutes. Baptist Fashion Show is your favorite song in the show?
It's my favorite song. So what it does is that it also, for those who haven't seen it, in the show, a youth is attending church with his mom, and he is waking up. It's kind of a ritual. It's their weekend ritual. And this is the first time that he gets, or he has a religious experience, but it's not a religious experience. It's his first time falling in love with music, falling in love with R&B, gospel, call and response, and his understanding of it, mm-hmm. Based on a documentary that he saw on PBS. It also is the inciting incident that takes place is that he acts a fool. He mm-hmm. embarrasses his mom in church.
She slaps the hell out of him.
And that moment, it allows him, or it kind of creates a distance between him and his mom, but also him and the church, mm-hmm. and puts him on the path to being a musician.
Mm-hmm. Well, because he joins the church choir, not for religious purposes, but to get closer to music, I guess. And then also, he's following his teenage hormones when Miss Edwina Williams is like, get up in here.
Yes.
Honestly, my favorite part of Deirdre's performance is her Edwina. That woman just nailed it so hard. But
it's so good.
So good. It's the thing about youth, which is, it's so weird to call the character youth, because it's also true of like youth in general. Yeah. But you know how like, we all walk down the street, mm-hmm. and we're the main character, because we are the main character of our lives. You know, we're the lead. And so not only is our opinion right, we think that, you know, everyone will share our opinion. Like, there's nothing insulting about our opinion. So when he has his religious experience at church and his insight and his, you know, epiphany of his new relationship to music and how church is related to music, he doesn't realize that, like, how he's acting is offensive to his mother, because it's very different for her what church does and what it means. And he never bothers to understand what it is she feels. Because there's the line in Mom's Song, she's like, why can't you make room for me in your world as I made room for you in mine? Exactly. And it's sort of like the nagging thing of the show of, you know, this woman who loves her child, doesn't understand her child, but loves him and is trying to, you know, get that connection back. And he just could not be bothered. And it's not until it's too late that, you know, he realizes how selfish and stupid he's been in this pursuit of trying to find the real. He's lost sight of all the real things around him, like his relationship with his mother, the love that was there. Because spoiler alert, what happens to mother?
Mother passes away from, we assume, cancer or some kind of virus, but she passes away.
Yeah.
When he is out in Berlin, he's mm-hmm. living his life. He's being a 20-something. He's following his hormones. He's following his passion. Yeah. He's, you know, slumming it. He's living the artist life, but in doing so, he kind of puts her aside. He stops communicating with her, and he misses her final moments.
He does. He ignores his roots to become someone new. And he now, you know, so much, there's now just so much regret in him that ultimately wakes him up. And I think that's probably what helps him become the better artist, is he actually now has had the true heartbreak and pain that comes from really kind of being blind for so long and losing so much all of a sudden. It's probably cancer. They don't say.
They don't say it all, but like you your mind goes places. You're like, how did she not?
Exactly. And also the timeline of Act Two is strange, passing strange, one might say, because it can feel like it's only been a few months. It's, I think he's in Berlin for a while, right? Like,
a while.
Yeah.
So he goes there during the May riots of 1987. Which were a big thing. This is right before the wall fell. Also similar to Hedwig.
I would say if there's one score in musical theater that we could connect Passing Strange to, it would be Hedwig.
It would be Hedwig.
Yeah.
And it feels like it feels like a time, but they actually, I think one line of dialogue, they actually clarify that how long he's actually been there. So he goes to Amsterdam, I want to say in like 1985, mm-hmm. and he's been, or in 1986. And then he goes to Berlin in 1987.
Yeah. Yeah, he's definitely in Amsterdam for a while, because that's the thing about Amsterdam, is it's such a paradise for him. It's such a, you know, magical place. And he gets so lost in the culture and the new world of it all that, you know, it's sort of like you blink and 6 months have passed, and you blink again and 9 months have passed. And part of the reason why he ends up leaving Amsterdam is because it's just so perfect, he can't write. He's either, I have no pain to communicate, I only have this wonderful whole feeling. I just feel so complete, I can't be here anymore. Which we're all sitting there being like, bitch, stay.
Right?
Do you know how rare it is to feel this way? Fucking stay. I don't know. I love how the show also just like plays around with genres all the time. Like when he decides he's gonna leave for Europe, it's like about to be this big emotional moment, and then the scene changes and they do like a French film.
Yeah, okay.
French film. It's so good. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, I think that like what the show does well. So like, so what, where it sits, I mean, yes, you can compare it to a Hedwig, especially. That's the only musical we can really compare it to.
But yeah, the template of Hedwig, I guess.
But I would argue that it's actually in a really interesting trifecta. I would say that, like, in terms of like Black expression and like what this kind of like this a new uh, not I would say it's music theater, or like it's musical theater, yes, but it's music theater. It's changing how musical theater is seen or expressed. So I would say that that trifecta would be The Bubbly Black Girl Sheds Her Chameleon Skin by Kirsten Childs, Passing Strange by Student Heidi, and then it would be A Strange Loop by Michael R. Jackson. And they're all, because one, they're just tethered together, like thematically, but also musically, they're kind of these form expanding musicals, each of them with their own sounds, where Bubbly has that explores like girl group, and it explores traditional musical theater, it explores R&B and show tunes. A Strange Loop explores like Lilith Fair, alternative rock. It explores gospel, folk, bedroom pop, alternative rock music. And Passing Strange is kind of tethered in between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And also thematically, Passing Strange, what that does by comparison is that it's looking at code switching. It's looking at Black identity, and it's doing it through this kind of fourth wall breaking odyssey. Mm-hmm. Age story. Bubbly Black Girl Sheds Her Chameleon Skin, what that's doing, while it's also kind of an odyssey, it's coming of age story, and it follows a character similarly over a similar period of time, about like 10-15 years, from a little girl to a young adult. That explores a young woman who is dealing with internalized racism and self-worth, and also segregation, or de facto segregation and racial profiling at that time, in the wake of like the 1966, the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. Mm. That particular show is looking at her experience of that, and her kind of coming into herself, and like really kind of not trying to be an angry Black woman, not trying to express rage, trying to hold it all in. Mm-hmm. And also with feeling a difference, kind of like going away, going to New York, not really running away from her roots, but like, she goes to New York and she tries to be an artist, you know, and this is based on Kirsten Child's career. She worked in with Richard Pryor. She has a very long career as a showgirl before she became a musical theater writer. And so you're watching her experience, you know, working with Bob Fosse on Chicago, having to like code switch as a Black performer.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you see, like, so thematically it's tethered to that. And Strange Loop, what that does, it's kind of honoring both of those shows and, like, looking at the legacy of both of those shows. But what it's doing is that it is exploring Black queer life in the age of Truvada and looking at that through the prism of, like, people kind of, you know, growing up in the age of social apps like Jacked and Grindr.
Yeah.
And what that can do to a fat Black queer person, and you know, and look at their self-worth, and also looking at how AIDS has affected the Black community and created divisions upon divisions upon divisions.
Yeah.
Looking at the double consciousness. So all of them, each of these shows, are looking at W.E.D. Boyce's Black consciousness, looking at the double consciousness that is forced on African Americans, feeling like you have, like you're both Black and you're both American, but you can't like be both, and like having to like walk that tightrope.
Yeah, and there being confines of like what you is you have to be like if you're gonna be both. Something I really like about Strange Loop, I'm not as familiar with Chameleon Skin as I am with Strange Loop and Passing Strange, but something I like about both of those shows is that with the protagonists, they do explore everything you're talking about, as well as on a human level, what it is about those characters in particular that is keeping them from achieving what it is they want to achieve. Because a lot of it is the world and society and community and the rigidness of what everyone in their communities are supposed to be, and then their own personal obstacles that are keeping them from becoming a better them, if that makes sense. Like with Usher, and I don't want to talk about Strange Loop too much because that is going to be the final episode of this series. I'm giving it this series is gonna go on for like the next 6 months, so I'm like giving it some time. But you know, with Usher, there's so much about him mentally and emotionally that is blocking him from everything around him, and part of it is a wall to protect himself from all the trauma that he has experienced and continues to experience every day. And then part of it is also just his self-defense mechanism just becomes a shield that keeps everything outside at arm's length. And you can't grow without interaction. You can't find any success unless you try with other things. And I do like that Strange Loop constantly is swinging back and forth between those two things. And I think Passing Strange does the same thing in a less harsh way, because youth has not really, and that what I actually, and I think part of the reason why there's so much humor in Passing Strange and why ultimately Passing Strange should be more palatable for audiences is like, youth's life has not been hard. And there is a conundrum for a lot of people about that. As a Black man in America, it's like, what do you mean that you come from a comfortable home and that you've had, there's been no violence or sexual predatoryness, or like you haven't had like any violence or drug problems? Like, what do you mean that you come from a household where everyone is educated and nice and intellectual? What do you mean? And him coming out and throw, be like, if I want to make an impact, do I have to like be damaged in a lot of ways? So he kind of puts on that skin that doesn't really fit him, because that's not what he's about. And does that make him less of a successful man of color in America if that's the case? And I think that is sort of an interesting perspective that Stu gives the show. And I like, because in order to tell everyone's story, we have to tell everyone's story. And that's something you were sort of talking about with the code switching with Kirsten Childs, was her name?
Yeah, so Kirsten Childs, yeah, her
Kirsten, sorry, Kirsten Child.
Yeah, no, what that does, what all three shows do, is looking at, because Kirsten also came from LA as well, mm-hmm. and but she makes her journey to New York, not to Europe.
Yeah,
and she came from, you know, a middle class home. She did not suffer from poverty. She did not have, you know, drugs in the household. There wasn't any kind of like, to, you know, at least in the play, there's no sexual violence. There's no, yeah. You know, we're not seeing we're not seeing Black trauma, in the way in which we're used to seeing it, because mm-hmm. that's what these shows kind of combating in a way. It's like the only way you want to see Black stories on stage is by having Black trauma, because Black trauma makes money. We don't make money from it, but
yeah, well, because it makes white shows like that for white audiences. Sorry, I can only speak from the white people that I sit around. But when I hear them talk about these shows, going to see these shows and talking about the importance of it all, I sit there going, do you think you've done the work by sitting there and feeling bad about yourself for 90 minutes? That's not like sitting there and watching a show about Black trauma is not doing the work. Like it's sitting there for 90 minutes saying mea culpa and then walking out and be like, I am such an ally because I sat there and felt bad for 90 minutes. Like, no, there are so many other stories to embrace and support. So I know, do you know, speaking of Kirsten Child, do you know who Candy Brown is? Candace Brown?
Candace Brown? Isn't that a playwright, I believe?
No. So she was a Broadway dancer in the 60s and 70s, and I think through the early 80s. She was a Fosse girl, worked with Michael Bennett a couple times. She's one of the original dancers that A Chorus Line is based off of. She was like in that core group that did that day where they basically sat and got drunk for 9 hours and talked about their lives. And
can't do that today. I'm like, can't do that today.
Can't do that today. But I mean, the character of Richie in A Chorus Line is inspired by her, and I'll talk about this more in the Chorus Line episode, I suppose. But like, part of the reason why Richie does not have any major trauma in the show is because Candy never really had any major trauma, and she's talked about this, and she's sitting there listening to all these people just cry about my parents, they don't love me, and I blah, blah, blah. And they get to Candace being like, well, Candy, tell us about being a Black woman in America. She's like, My parents love me and want me to be happy. I was like, I went to school. I never wanted for anything. I came to New York. I got a job. It's all been good. I'm so sorry. Like, she's like, I'm so sorry that I can't tell you guys about the sad life. She's like, I've done very well. And but like, that's, I that story is just as valid as any other story. And I like having all these different perspectives. And it's always humorous to me to watch white audiences be like, huh? I'm like, yeah, believe it or not, there are people who are not white who've had very successful, wonderful, full lives.
I remember when I owned everything. The sun and the moon and the rain. My domain stretched and yawned along the astral plane. The universe is a toy in the mind of a boy. And life is a movie too, starring you.
I really can't talk about Strange Loop too much because I have so much to say about that thing. And I have to save it for the episode. But I will say, Memory Song is when all the theatrics go away. And he's just raw and there.
Yeah, and if you were like look at it too, I mean, they do it in Passing is Strange as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Where everything kind of goes away, and he's you know, it's really, I mean, he's kind of got head working the wound, and then he just go, you know, he sets the scene for his mother in this really moment.
the art finally has a moment of human connection and love, and it's the simplicity of it all after, you know, 2 hours of everything, of just kind of just stopping it all and saying, you know what, like, as exciting as this is, hot as this is, electrifying as this is, this, none of this is real. We keep talking about, and he says that he gets to this at the end where he's like, we keep talking about the real and youth keeps looking for the real. And he talks about Pretzel Man.
That monologue kills me every time.
I'm trying to find the exact I wrote down some of the words that Pretzel Man said. I didn't write all of it, but the kid is looking for something in life that can only be found in art. Some people find art more meaningful than life, and there is an artifice to art, of course, right? But what everyone's always trying to do when they're telling a story theatrically or dramatically is, you know, finding kernels of truth and presenting them in a way that everyone can connect to, and there are varieties of ways to do that. Either you go super hardcore on the reality and like just make it a minuscule moment of life and make it as detailed as possible, or you go for a bigger picture and you make it a little more abstract so everyone can kind of project their journeys onto it. It's, you know, the corporate negativity people have like about One Direction songs, it's like, and that Bo Burnham made fun of, is like, they're so generic about the girl they're describing that every girl in the world thinks it's about them, like, girl, I love your face because your face is on your body, and every girl's like, my face is on my body. But so with Passing Strange, Stu and Heidi really kind of just, they throw every genre of music out there, including like even kernels of musical theater. They do it for, you know, comedic effects because they don't really know how to write musical theater stuff. They don't look down upon it.
Big moment. It's like he tries to sing his I'm not gonna take
I'm it. Getting out of this town song, he says.
That's what it's called. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he says, I can't write it.
Yeah. But I think what makes it so good for people like me who, you know, are true musical theater babies is like Heidi and Stu have no disrespect for musical theater. They like it. Like Heidi actually likes musical theater not likes it more than Stu, but she's known it longer than Stu has. They both enjoy musical theater. They're just like, that's not how our brains think of songs, and that's totally okay. They've learned a lot from musical theater in terms of storytelling, which I really appreciate. But yeah, he's like, we tried to write it, we couldn't. And so there's no mean-spiritedness about it. The humor just comes from like, we tried, couldn't do it.
I mean, that's kind of the ethos of his whole, you know, of their whole songwriting career, because I mean, they really only have two musicals. They have this, they have another show called The Total Band, which was at the public,
and I totally saw it too.
I saw both iterations of it. So I saw the original when they were trying it, and it was come and whatever, well, you know, we're just going to fix it, and then we're going to actually do the presentation later. and very different shows, both
yeah.
of them.
What they have in common, Total Bent and Passing Strange, is that they are both very much a vibe. And I don't mean that in the way that, like, Instagram girls say, like, she's such a vibe. I mean, like, you're in the theater and there's an electricity about the way that Stu and Heidi write music and the way that they use it for storytelling that even if you're not entirely sure what's going on, you are very much involved. Yeah. And, like, I cannot tell you what the plot of The Total Bent was. I remember something about a recording studio.
It's about a son and a father and son. Well, it's changed. So, like, the version that... Did you see the recent version? The last...
I saw whatever was at the Public at the Empashker Theater, whatever it's called, where Passing Strain was.
Was it with the guy from that show?
Yeah, that guy who did The Thing.
The Thing. oh, my God. It was a great movie. It's a great show. Anyway.
The guy who played the son, I don't know if he was known yet or if he got known right after that, but the guy who played the son... What?
Yeah, with Kristen. what is that show called? I'm gonna be so mad. I watched it. I watched all of it. It
was show with Kristen.
Kristen. With Dan and Kristen.
Oh, Kristen Bell. No,
Kristen Bell. Yes,
Kristen Bell and Dak Shepherd did a show together.
They did something. That's how they met. But I'm saying she did a show with the guy from Total Bent. And what is that show called?
House of Lies?
No. It was called...
Good Place?
Good Place. Thank you so much.
Who from The Good Place was in The Total Bent? Was it Chidi?
Chidi.
Chidi was in The Total Bent?
That's what I'm remembering. Yeah, okay.
Marcus Scott, you've been sitting on this information.
I was like, yeah. No, so the guy... Who did? Yeah, his.
You, no, you do. No, you do not. Wait, I don't. I don't trust you. I don't trust you as far as I can throw you. I am convinced that you were getting your wires crossed because for the last 10,000 years, you were calling him that guy from The Thing who did the stuff, and I do not trust you as far as I can throw you.
He was in a good place. Yeah. And so his name is William Jackson Harper. Yes, he was. In
yeah, that's him.
So like he was in the show Total Bent.
So he did it in 2012, I guess.
Yes. So
yes, he did, because I saw the one in 2016. Okay. That's not who I saw.
So who was, I forgot. It doesn't matter.
It matters to me because that's when I saw it, and I if I fucking saw Chidi do the show, I will lose myself.
Yeah, he did. That's when I saw it. Okay. I saw both. Yeah, that's so he did the first version of it.
He played the son in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And who played it?
Was it? It was A2.
Langston Wood, who I eventually saw in Slave Play. Yes.
Slave Play.
When I saw Slave Play, I was like, I remember you. And I don't remember why. And then I looked in his program, like, Total Bent, that's right. He has a song when he like takes over the mic and he's like standing on a chair or something and he's just like feeling his body. And I was like, that is the track that I want to do if I ever go back on a stage. I want to play a role where I get to sing a Stu song and I just get to feel my body on a chair in front of everyone. I want that life.
No, it was. I mean, it has one of the best songs too. It's called "Mary Magdalene." Mm-hmm. I love that song. It's a whole bop. But yeah, what I would say about that show, what that show did was it's about a father and son who go to who are trying to record an album. They have a gospel act, and the son has been under the father's shadow for a long time, and he strikes out on his own to become his own artist. What the show really is about, like if we look at it from like a metaphorical thing, it's actually following like the passion of Christ. Like he has, it's literally looking at like his rise and then it's looking at like his downfall.
Yeah.
Or if you're looking at it from a pop culture stance, it's the closest thing to like the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spider from Mars. Mm-hmm. It's looking at the rise of an icon and the fall, downfall.
I also love that you're like, here are all the levels and layers to the show and the religious elements. And I'm like, I just liked it when he was being a slut on a chair.
No, I mean, it's a very philosophically, it's actually very, and also it helps that I got to meet Stu at the 2012 version. Mm. And I spoke to him about both Passing Strange and the show. Of course, I was going up to him as like a fan, not because I know Stu.
Now you know Stu. You're like, oh, that man, he and I. Well, what did you guys talk about in regards to Passing Strange? Because that is, technically speaking, the show we're talking about. Yes.
I was working on my thesis, which is not like Passing Strange, but I was asking him about, you know, just about the criticisms he got and like how did he come along to like the structure of it. And he just said it was like a lot of it was rehearsal, and a lot of it he really gave a lot of power to the director, and so that really helped shape him, because he's like, he says, you know, he's a storyteller, he's a songwriter, but in terms of like shaping the show to what it became a lot of her teaching him like the mechanics of how to write a musical.
Yeah, well, that's also the power of collaboration. And this show was in development for 3-4 years. They started as a workshop at Sundance Theater Lab, which is, people remember, is where Fun Home was developed, and I think Carolina Change even had some development there. A lot of shows that people would know.
And they also got some stuff there as well.
Who did?
Strange Loop.
Strange Loop, yeah. The thing with Passing Strange, so usually you go for like a season to develop and whatever, and then you go off and you do workshops elsewhere. Passing Strange is one of the few musicals that got asked back 2 years in a row to come back for further development, which they did. And then they did their world premiere at Berkeley Rep, I think, in 2006. That sounds right. Yeah. And then they did their production at the Public in the spring of 2007, and then moved to Broadway in the early part of 2008. So that's, I mean, that's a lot of development.
And that's a lot of development, but if you think about it, that's actually very short for musicals. I mean, considering like that Hamilton took 7-8 years to write.
Yes. Well, Hamilton is also like the danger of when one person is responsible for creating all of it. And Stu very much is like the brainchild of Passing Strange, but he's still held accountable by working with Heidi, by having Annie as his director. You know, basically Lynn had sort of Tommy Kail check in every 9 months, be like, did you write a song, Lynn? You write a song today?
He's like, I wrote one a year.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, we have to like, we're gonna like expedite this right now. We have to.
I relate hard to Lynn in the sense that like, you give me a deadline and I will get it done, but if left to my own devices, like I will say, well, I wrote a scene yesterday so I can spend the rest of the week playing video games, which is not really how that works.
But also, we just have so many different distractions now. I mean, like, that, that's what true. Is it? I did a story about Stephen Sondheim for the New York City Center for Into the Woods. And in my research, I found out that like they wound up writing like Gypsy in like 4 months.
It's that was an anomaly, because like for people who want more information on Gypsy, you can go back to that episode in the Stephen Sondheim series called A Little Sondheim Music. But it really, that show is an anomaly for all of them, because Arthur's never written anything as good before or since. My hot take is that Arthur Lawrence was a very smart man who wrote a couple of good things and like two great things, but wrote also like a lot of crap that he never was willing. He always blamed the failures of his plays on other people. And I'm like, girl, you wrote like 7 Broadway plays that all flopped. Maybe the problem is you. And Sondheim, God love him, procrastinator up the wazoo, and also like collaborating with Arthur and Julie Stein, so like had people who was holding him accountable. And like, most shows are not written that fast. I think the only Broadway show that was successful that was written faster than Gypsy was Wonderful Town, but that was because they had to do a complete overhaul between like Broadway and Out of Town and Broadway. Like, they had a whole different creative team, and then Compton Green and Leonard Bernstein came in, and they're like, guys, we have to throw everything out, start from scratch. And they're like, oh shit, oh, we got a month to do this. And I mean, Wonderful Town is a good show, it's not as great as Gypsy, but considering they had like a month to write it, you're like, God bless. But
I mean, what shows are as good as Gypsy? Like, you know,
it's really true. I mean, Gypsy is objectively pretty perfect. My guest Preston Max Allen found one flaw in it, which is that there is no indication whatsoever in the show that Louise will ever become Gypsy Rosalie. Like, she never makes an astute observation or a comical wisecrack. Just like, you need one or two moments that can foreshadow who she could become if she comes out of her shell. So when she does, it's not a total surprise. As it is, this, it's all on the actress to create that arc during the strip. Yeah. And Benanti has probably come the closest to really
exactly.
Benanti pretty much nails it, but again, because it's such an uphill battle, she doesn't, she, I wouldn't say she's like 100% successful at making you go, oh yes, the trajectory makes perfect sense now. She just, she navigates it as good as anyone can. And that is all you can ask of her. It's not her fault that Arthur Lawrence gave her no setup until that moment to become Gypsy Rose Lee.
We just had sex. There's nothing sleazy about a natural reflex. It's nice and easy, no need to crane your necks. It's all cool breezy, baby. What's a little bedroom traffic? Evening news is pornographic.
We just had sex.
That's right, all three of us.
It's not complex.
It's no big deal at all.
We'll smoke cigarettes and probably talk about
10 or 15 things
before anyone brings up the fact that
we just had sex.
That might be another reason why there's, why it's difficult for that show to continue to thrive, is there's the question of, can that show be performed effectively without Stu? Like, does the artifice become too much when you have someone playing him?
I would argue that yes, it could still work. The thing I think, though, to your point, when it comes to Scansion and prosody, that if you were to hand someone the book, you know, the script to Passing Strange and say, mm-hmm. go compose it, mm-hmm. that no one would come close to the breath and the, I don't want to say it's deep, but just like the heart and the soul of it, the mm-hmm. because of I just think that musical theater, it takes an outsider, someone who's not a musical theater person, mm-hmm. to write the show that he wrote. Mm-hmm. Musical theater, I think that like there are musical theater composers and artists who are currently working in the form, that are pushing it, that are really kind of taking it places and taking it to exciting places. But so much of them have the same influences. Mm-hmm. You have your Lacusa composers, you have your Sondheim composers, you have your Larson composers. But I think that this right here is pulling from so many traditions outside of musical theater, mm-hmm. that almost you need to kind of have that world culture that he kind of like cultivated throughout his career.
Absolutely. Yeah.
His artistry to bring it to the stage, and because it's pulling from so many different places, I just think it's impossible for someone to sit there and try to emulate the sounds that he's emulating. You can watch it, you can study it, but it's one of those things of, if it doesn't live in you, it doesn't live in you. And this is one of those examples. And I would say to compare it, same thing with a Hedwig. Like, you know, you could listen to David Bowie, but if you aren't absorbing David Bowie, you can't write Midnight Radio.
No.
If you are interested in the New York Dolls and you're listening to their albums and you're absorbing their music, that's how you write a sugar daddy. But you can't write you can't write a Origin of Love if you're not listening to Roxy music, or if you're not listening to like the music of that time, it just won't happen. And I think that like it's something, it's very similar to Stu. He's pulling from, you know, the Clark sisters. He's pulling from, you know, Muddy Waters. He's pulling from some Princes in there. All of the influences that he highlights, he's pulling from Josephine Baker and her Cabaret acts. You know, so he's all of that is in the show.
Yeah. Well, so two things. Number one, the way you sort of talk about Stu and how he approaches the show, and when you talk about like outsiders of musical theater coming in and writing musical theater works and sort of changing the game just due to them not being part of the world, it's one of the rare instances where like ignorance is bliss. I don't know if you've ever. Mm-hmm. read any interviews. The way you were just talking about Stu reminded me of the way Orson Welles talked about making Citizen Kane, which was his first film as a film director. And when people said, like, you know, you created so many cinematic things that we do today that no one ever done before, like, how did you think to do it? And he's like, I didn't know how to make a movie. No one told me you couldn't do it. He's like, I don't know. Like, we got on set. I was like, could we maybe move the camera this way? And no one told me no. And that's sort of the way I feel like Stu and Heidi created Passing Strange. Was like, they would write things that just sort of came to them that seemed organic and natural. And it was so different from anything else because they didn't really know that no one did that. It's just where their heads went. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, there's a wonderful ignorance to all of that, that really creates fantastic new works, where learning about the pillars of theatrical storytelling help is sort of just in the consistency of churning out more stage works. But I think what you're talking about, that I fully believe, and I wish more people did this, is just exposure to everything and absorbing everything. You know, you talked about Sony Musical Theater Writers. Now we have our people emulating Lin and Sondheim and Lacusa, and then the new Pasek and Pauls doing the, everyone trying to write the next This Is Me. And I'm like, go fuck yourself. But the world is so immense, and art, there's just a never ending fountain of art coming out, and there's hundreds, thousands of years of art to absorb. You got to look at as much of it as you can of various degrees. Not, if you're writing a musical, don't just look at every musical that's ever been written. Listen to different genres of rock, country, doo-wop. Watch movies. Sondheim loved movies. He would think of musical theater as a film score. Books, TV, go out into the street and see what's going on out there. Experience some new life. There's just so much to take in, and it can influence you to write anything. And as we were talking about the different flavors of this score, you know, in the same way that it reminds me a lot of Carolina Change or Great Comet, that's like, it doesn't adhere to one specific genre. It has an overall thematic genre. But like, when people say, oh, is Passing Strange a rock musical? It's like, yeah, overall it's rock, but it's not rock as you would think it. And there are other genres mixed in there as well. Gospel, blues, Europop, Eastern European performance art. That whole what's inside is just a lie. I'm like, everyone needs to do that once sophomore year of college, just to throw the spaghetti at the wall and try something.
Yes, agreed.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Like, yeah, I mean, I feel just very strongly about that. I mean, I have a degree in musical theater writing, but I don't come from, you know, I wasn't born with musicals strapped to my arm. You know, I wasn't sitting in front of, you know, watching Oliver or, you know, Annie. Those were really the only shows I knew, actually. Like, you know, I thought that was a musical. I was like, I hate that. You know,
Marcus is saying all this while looking directly into my eyes and just dragging me through the dirt. Wow, Marcus. Wow. I didn't know until this moment how much you hated me, everything I stood for, and everything I've lived for.
But like, no, like I didn't have that. And so like, but like, it freed me to like write and like figure out form by watching and kind of like by falling in love with it as an outsider coming in. It kind of changed the way I thought of like stories and like, and that, and in many ways it's worked against me, you know, because I'm not a scholar. I can tell you what I know, what I can sit there and I can critique something. I can tell you what is working, what's not. Mm-hmm. I can tell you what the formula is. I can tell you like the history of it if I know enough about the subject, but I'm not a scholar on musical theater. I do think that like it has been a benefit to me, and it's been a benefit to a lot of artists coming in who just take from different backgrounds. And I think that what Stu has done, even though he hasn't been as prolific as some of his peers in musical theater, is that he really kind of created a lane not only for himself, but like for a lot of like new and up and coming writers. And that's how you get a Strange Loop. I mean, a Strange Loop is greatly indebted to, you know, this particular show. And I would even argue, you know, plays as well that are coming up, and art playwrights who are trying to figure out who they are, have been influenced by it. I mean, Ain't No More, go to that. that's opening on Broadway. And even though you can argue that it is more of a Chicken and Biscuits than it is a Passing Strange or mm-hmm. it's a Colored Museum, that, you know, as it is, it's still, there are still moments of clarity that are in that.
I haven't seen it yet. That doesn't stop me from having a million opinions about it.
Oh, have you?
Welcome to being a theater gay. No, I fully intend to see it. And one of the actresses from Chicken and Biscuits is in it as well.
Yes.
It's Ebony Marshall. Is that who's in it?
I believe so. Yeah. I also know that, like, there's an actress, I think Crystal Lucas Perry, who's currently in 1776.
Not currently anymore, because Ain't No More has now started performances. She left 1776 to go do Ain't No More. Yeah. I'm hoping that she's enjoying her time in Ain't No More more so than she was in 1776. But we're not talking about 1776. We're not even talking about Crystal Lucas Perry. We're talking about Passing Strange. Although, same theater. Although I also do want to say, speaking of toxic asshole and pompous douchebag Arthur Lawrence, his Patti LuPone Gypsy was the same season as Passing Strange. And
yes,
I have discussed Patti LuPone Gypsy on this podcast before. I was not a fan of it. As much as I thought Benanti was stellar. I know. Oh, Marcus is like retreating within himself. He's like, oh no.
I loved it. I'm sorry.
Many people did. Listen, here, my issue with that Patti LuPone Gypsy was it was just a little too much. And I did see it twice. I saw it towards the end of previews, and then I saw it in August because a friend wanted to see it. And I would actually argue that Patti got better, and a lot of the show, in my opinion, got a little sluggish because it was 3 hours long. It was the longest show of all time. Because every line was important and everyone on stage was like, no one has ever acted like I've acted before. I am acting like an actor. I know this is a musical, but we're actors. And if you read every single interview with Arthur Lawrence, he was like, the difference between this production and any production that's ever productioned is that this production is acting. And I'm like, Arthur, we get it. You wrote the Book of Gypsy. That's enough. But so he got a Tony nomination for director for that. And I was furious because oh God, what's Annie's last name from Passing Strange? Annie Dorson. I was like, how dare you give Arthur Lawrence a Tony nomination for making Gypsy 4 hours long? And Annie Dorson, who shaped Passing Strange, who gave it a point of view, who made the whole thing come together, gets shafted. I say shenanigans, Tony Awards. I say shenanigans.
So with the shafted, that whole musical, I mean, the fact that it only got best book for musical, I mean... Yeah. That says,
well, that's another conversation, because then it becomes the In the Heights versus Passing Strange of it all.
In the Heights was great. I mean, like, it's a wonderful musical, but
because you became familiar with Passing Strange once the movie came out, not when it was on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Were you like at all in tune with sort of the conversations of the Broadway scene that year?
So that year I was an undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
And I was I had just become an acting major, so I was very much because I was a double major in journalism and acting.
I like how you and I describe our acting years like gay people talk about when they were still in the closet. Like, I was confused, I was figuring myself out.
Then I was like, you know, I want to be a writer. That's what happened. I was like, why do I like the stage? Oh, I want to write stories. Mm. I don't want to act. But
I like acting. I like the attention. I just don't want to audition ever again. Just give me a job. Don't make me audition.
Yeah, I like acting. I don't like the staginess of it. I also like, I learned too that like I like the process of it. Like being the rehearsal and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
But when you're on stage and you're doing it every night and you're at the stage,
1,000%. I interrupted you. You were in your confused stage.
Sorry. So, oh my God, what was I talking about?
You were experimenting with acting.
Thank you. So I had gotten into, really watching the Tonys and really like being on top of like the history of it, because I was around like a bunch of like theater gays, and they're gonna read me for filth. So I was like, no, I have to watch, you know, like know what's going on. And so I was very much a part of like what was going on with that season. But I feel that like why I would argue it's just a better book than In the Heights. It's just this right here is tackling a million themes. Mm-hmm. It's messing with structure in ways that were up until that point. I mean, like you really didn't see structure being messed with that much really since like A Hair, I would argue. Mm-hmm. Which is another musical I'm very, very I know very well.
it was between this and Hair for you. You narrowed it down to this and Hair, and I said, which one do you want to tackle, babe?
And I was like, probably this one. I have a lot to say about this one. And also just like, I would argue that by comparison to between this and In the Heights, I just feel that like In the Heights, everyone will tell you it's the I hate to say it like this and to put it in this way, but it's the six versus the strange aloofness of it all.
Mm.
No, it's a lot more accessible.
So again, you know, I don't want to talk about it too much because I have to cover it for another episode on this series, yeah. In the Heights. In the Heights is an interesting case because it is a good musical. Passing Strange 1000% has the better book. You can debate the two scores because they're just so very different. And In the Heights has some amazing music and some great songs. Some of those songs I prefer to songs in Hamilton. It's like there's like a fire to some mm-hmm. of those songs in the Heights. It's just exceptional. Passing Strange 1000% has a better book. And In the Heights' book is better than the screenplay for the movie. But
yes,
I watched the movie. I was like, congratulations, you made me miss the libretto. But which I never thought I would say. But I did. I missed the libretto for In the Heights. But In the Heights was so interesting because I actually saw it off Broadway with the teen critics group that Aisa Davis was teaching. And I remember we all came out and we were like, that was pleasant. And, you know, obviously they made some changes for Broadway, but we all were like, that was nice. And when it moved to Broadway, there were some, I don't know what it is that they were able to lock into, because Passing Strange opened about a month before In the Heights, and for some reason the community just decided that In the Heights was the show they were going to champion, like that was the underdog that we were going to make a hit. And I liked it, but most Tony years, Marcus, I am the lone wolf. The year of Spring Awakening, much as I loved it, I was very much team Grey Gardens. The year of Spamalot and Spelling Bee, I was team Line in the Piazza. So I'm like, every year I'm always like, I'm the outlier. And so for that year I was like team Passing Strange. And everyone was like, no, In the Heights, like art's going to win out in the day. I'm like, they're both artistic achievements in very different ways. But Passing Strange is, it's not that In the Heights is more feel good, because like Passing Strange isn't a hard say. Like it's not, as you said, it's not trauma porn. It's very funny. It's very heartwarming. There's a lot of lightness to it. But I think a lot of people expected it to be kind of a hard sit in that way. And In the Heights is a little more catering to traditional musical theater values of how to present a story, how to put an audience at ease. And to get like, it's so weird to say all this because like I don't think Passing Strange doesn't put an audience at ease. Like I think anyone who came through the door liked it and thought like, oh, this is so much more engaging than I thought it would be. It was just about getting people through the door. We couldn't get them to come fast enough. I couldn't get you to come up fast enough that season. It took you a year. I was there. Where were you?
Yeah, no, I also think that like politically too, there was also that notion too. I think politically, because you had Paul Simon had like the Caper Man or something like that.
The Cape Man.
Before that, and they also had like the Kiss of the Spider Woman. Mm-hmm. You know, it was this right here was the first show that had like a Latinx man, you know, Asian descent, creating a musical that like was bringing these authentic sounds to Broadway and doing it with a finesse in a musical theater swagger. And I think that was just politically, that was just a very like it was time for that show to become what it was. Also, just like you know, like you said at the earlier, like it's just passing strange. I think the only really takeaway song that you can have is My Keys, mm-hmm. and that's stitched to another song. Yeah, like it's all right. You know, there's not really a song that you can like you can kind of like hum, at a cabaret or sing in a shower, really, yeah. Without having to you know really listen to the entire album as a whole. And so yeah, I think that it was a thing. I think that like people like songs that you can kind of not diegetic songs, that's not what it is, but I think you need songs that kind of like
well so it sounds so I've definitely talked about this before. There's a little bit of a not psychotic, but like you have to be a little there's what was the term where like where you're kind of like emotionally subtracted from it all. You're not like you're not a psychopath, you're a you have to be a little bit of a sociopath when writing musical theater, because you are capturing you're trying to capture parts of the human experience and human emotion and bottling it up in a structured way so that everyone can appreciate it and
hum it.
And hum it, yeah. Well, and so and this is where the double-edged sword of Heidi and Stu's ignorance of musical theater storytelling comes into play, because you have the one side, which is by not knowing what they didn't know, they broke all these barriers that they didn't know they were breaking. And as you said, like created a new lane for writers like Michael R. Jackson to now come up with a strange loop. Side note, I had this thought when you kept talking about the two of them. We should do a double feature of Strange Loop and Passing Strange, and the week is called A Passing Strange Loop. So like Wednesday's Passing Strange, Thursday's Strange Loop, and it's A Passing Strange Loop week. But you have someone like Lynn who totally gets musical theater. Mm-hmm. And within The Heights, you know, we got that killer opening in The Heights, which it's this big, big number that just gets you fucking riled up. And then Act One ends with Blackout, which is an amazing Act One finale. And Passing Strange doesn't end Act One with Keys, It's All Right. It ends with Just When It Was Starting to Feel Real. And that's, it's kind of like peters out that way. And it does, and even the show doesn't end on the big high that In the Heights ends with the I'm home, bam.
Yeah, no, like I mean, like what Lynn did really well is like you got In the Heights, the opening. You also got like I think it's 96,000.
Yep,
which is a really big number. Then you got the club scene, the dance scene.
Yep, the club slash blackout.
Yeah,
fireworks. Yeah.
Yeah, and the way it, you know, look at the fire. Is it, there's so many like earworms. So, mm-hmm. And you kind of already kind of see the Disneyfication of Lynn.
Yeah,
kind and into his powers.
Yeah, and there's sort of a methodical formula to it all, which I'm not saying to undermine what he does, and I'll talk about this more again with the In the Heights episode. It's really impressive to do it and make it sound so organic and surprising. I did say, though, when I finally listened to We Don't Talk About Bruno, after, you know, it breaking the internet, I was like, oh, what's this song that's more popular than Let It Go? And I listened to it, I'm like, oh, this is his Encanto version of 96,000. It's structured literally the same way as 96,000, which is not a bad thing. 96,000 is one of the all-time great group numbers, but I was surprised. I was like, oh, this is what broke the internet? But yeah, like it's
a great song. I mean,
it's a lovely song.
You know, like
it's no part of your world, but it's fine. It's but like there is something about In the Heights of sort of the crowd pleasingness of it all, and I'm not trying to say this as a negative about it. I don't want to harp on it again too much again because I have this episode that I got to do for it. But there is a crowd pleasingness about it that doesn't feel desperate, but definitely is sort of like we are letting you in, audience, and we are welcoming you in with open arms. And when you come in, you just know we're gonna give you pie, we're gonna give you punch, we're gonna give you a comfy chair, we're gonna make sure you are good to go. Whereas Passing Strange is more like, we are going to wrap our arms around you, and we're not going to let you go until the show is over. And you're not like, it's all going to be good, but just know that you're in my arms until the entire time. And there's a difference between like enveloping and welcoming in. And I love both. I think there's room for both, but there are a lot of audiences that just kind of want to be welcomed in. They don't want to be encased. Does that make sense?
Well, I agree. I would say that, like, also these are both shows that by two relatively new composers. One is like shooting his, you know, his everything at the, you know, at the wall and just trying to tell a story. Mm-hmm. Other one is trying to be the next Stephen Sondheim, you know, mm-hmm. of his generation. And you can see very two different things in effect. And yeah. I think that, like, you know, while both of them bringing and changing the landscape of musical theater, I mean, that was a really good year for musicals.
I'll say that was a really fucking incredible Tony year. And the thing we're not even talking about besides Patti LuPone and Gypsy, that was also the year of South Pacific coming in. And South Pacific really was the thing that dominated that season. And yeah. It's very easy to look back and go, oh, of course, the Golden Age Lincoln Center Theater revival. That was not... The season did not begin and everyone was like, oh, of course, South Pacific's going to be the thing. South Pacific had everything not going for it. Every one of us thought that show has not been on Broadway in almost 60 years. And Lincoln Center has been batting zero for the last like 4 years since Lightning the Piazza. Like, everything has been bad and dull, and, you know, for upper middle class white people. And South Pacific came out and we're like, oh, this revival kind of fucks. Like, we were all very surprised. And so that season, we had Patti LuPone Gypsy, we had the really lovely Sunday in the Park with George, we had In the Heights being so much fun, we had Passing Strange breaking all the rules, and we had Xanadu just being a good gay time.
Yep, you had Xanadu, and you had Crybaby.
Yeah, we don't talk about Crybaby.
I mean,
you like Crybaby?
I thought that Crybaby was a really good attempt at trying to do John Waters.
Sure.
I thought that's what it was.
There were two moments in Crybaby where I was like, here we go. One was Ali Mazzi doing Screw Loose, and then the other was the Escape from Prison dance. I was like, this is the show I want. Everything else, I went, okay.
I mean, but also, real talk, the movie's kind of like, okay.
The movie's not as good as we all think it is, but the movie is a lot of fun.
No, it's not.
It has one of my favorite lines, Ricky Lake saying, "My brother wouldn't touch your titties with a 10-foot pole. He likes his girls bad, Lenora, not cheap."
Iconic.
Yeah. Listen, it's not as good as Hairspray. It's not as good as Pink Flamingos or Female Trouble, but it's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun. I just feel that, like, you know, you can't really do it's. There's two playwrights you really like. It's really hard to musicalize. It'd be screenwriter / playwright John Waters, and it would be Charles Bush. Like, it's hard to do camp. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh my God. Can you imagine though a Die Mommy Die musical or a Lady in the Lady in Question might work as a musical.
I could imagine them both, and I just think that you would need someone who naturally is campy, like, who has the ability to do that. And camp is hard. Camp,
yeah.
You know, you have to have the ability.
I think if you could get, I hate him very much, but he is very good at parody lyrics. Randy Rainbow to do the lyrics and then someone fun for the music. That could be a fun time. But we're not here to brainstorm that. The fun thing about this season though, also, by the way, we're also neglecting this. This was the season of Young Frankenstein and Little Mermaid, two shows that everyone expected to be like huge behemoths that came in with hot ticket sales for about 6 months and then just died. And the Tony Awards ignored them both for musical. And Little Mermaid got a score nomination, but that's just because Xanadu was ineligible.
I mean, yeah. No, yeah. Little Mermaid on roller skates. And the other show that was on roller skates.
We had two roller skating shows that year. My God.
We just needed
the Starlight Express revival, and we were golden, Pony Boy.
Right. And Young Frankenstein. I mean, I think the problem with that show is it didn't have the musicality of like the producers.
That was a show where they definitely came at it with the confidence of, we did the producers, we know what we're doing. And so there was a smugness about that show, not just in terms of the writing, but also in terms of how big they made it. And then they had bad blood because they had kicked out the show before them. I think they were kicking out the Pirate Queen or something like that, which was already like bombing. But there was already, you know, like I think it was Pirate Queen. Don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure it was Pirate Queen. And the story goes, like, they were in the middle of, like, a put-in rehearsal. And they saw Mel Brooks and Susan Stroman touring the theater with the theater owners. And they're like, well, we're getting kicked out soon. And then they, you know, did the $400 ticket. They weren't going to release their grosses. And everyone's like, go fuck yourself. They came in so smug.
I mean, yeah. And it closed. It closed badly. And
we're not doing an episode on them. So that shows you what their legacy is.
That's true. But yeah, like, I think that, like, you know, I think the blessing and the curse of A Passing Strange that season is that because it was the de facto, I don't want to call it a Black musical, because, you know, but it was, mm-hmm. And because it was the de facto rock musical, like, in a way, because, I mean, yes, you know, Crybaby had rock and roll, but it wasn't, it was 50s rock and roll. This right here was, like, the cool downtown show that was bringing rock and roll up and doing it in a way that, like, hadn't been seen really since a Hedwig when it was off Broadway. Yeah. In many ways, it kind of catered for, you know, the way, or led the way for Hedwig to come on Broadway years later.
Same theater, no less.
Same theater.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that, like, the problem with A Passing Strange that year, it was a very traditional music year, and it needed I think that, like, had it come out even a couple of years ago, you know, barring the pandemic, it would have probably won a Pulitzer, or, you know.
Oh yeah.
But I think that, like, it was just, it needed, even though you can argue that this show, there's a lot of a scandal and controversy surrounding this musical, but it needed a Next to Normal, which came out, unfortunately, the following year.
Unfortunately. Yeah. Well, it's...
Because structurally, I mean, like, it's a rock musical, right? But, like, it's exploring folk music, you know, it's exploring alternative rock, it's exploring... soft pop and soft rock,
yeah.
Sounds, and it's putting that all that, and it was doing, it was exploring musical terrain that Passing Strange was already exploring, but it did it in a very cohesive way. And
I'm going to hold off my Next to Normal thoughts for the Next to Normal episode, which is going to happen at some point.
Yeah.
We're very much going out of order on this series, which I'm not mad about. It's been fun. It's been fun to just jump all over the place.
Yeah.
But it's so interesting because Next to Normal, the landscape is smaller in terms of what it's trying to cover storytelling wise.
Yeah.
But I also would argue it's less truthful about what it's covering. Mm-hmm. And that is, so it's, there's something about shows that come to Broadway and are unapologetic about presenting unvarnished truth and messy reality that audiences can't always accept. And some shows do it to various degrees of success. I think Passing Strange is a show that does it very successfully. Strange Loop is another one that I think does it very successfully. But it doesn't matter really how successful the writer and production team are at presenting it. If it really gives you that unvarnished truth, that messy reality, it almost never catches on with audiences. It is very rare when it does.
It's very rare. I think that, like, it's very much a big part of musical theater, whether the shows close early. I mean, Strange Loop's closing in January. You know, it won the Pulitzer, it won the Tony for Best Musical and Best Play, but it's closing. And you can say it's because of the current market, and we're all, you know, we're coming out of this pandemic, and, you know, just Broadway's not making as much money as it used to previously. You know, we've made upwards like $900 million, you know, this year, but typically Broadway's been making a couple of billion dollars a year. And so, what those shows do is that they wind up closing and then they catch on with the community and then people want a revival. And that's how these shows really the life, you know, of a writer, you know, where they kind of create a career for them. But I think that like, it's a thing about audiences really not accepting that people want their sugar in their coffee, you know?
I go back and forth with my views of audiences. Some days I'm like, you're all terrible and I hate you all and you all need to read a book. And then there are some days where I'm like, I think some of you are trying, but because it's not just like the sugar, it's so fascinating with these shows that don't always catch on at first and then become these classics later on. All it really is just more familiarity. You know, it's having it around you more and listening to it a couple more times. And just the repetition of it all, when it becomes part of your, not your routine, but I'll use the word again. When you become more familiar with it, you appreciate it more and you want to see it more. You know, we talk about this all the time with like Sondheim shows. Company, while it technically was a hit when it opened, it was sort of like barely a hit. It won the Tony and it kind of just made back its money, but the reviews were very divided. Audiences were left cold by it. It's only become a classic now because over 50 years, it's been in our culture. So we've had more exposure to it. But I mean, if a company like show came out today with the way the company did its own self, you know, unvarnished truth and weird abstract storytelling about, you know, our culture in a way that's just very much a mirror to our faces, many audiences would still be like, no, thank you. And it would be 15 years later when the songs are much more part of like the musical theater canon. We go, oh, we should bring that show back. That score is actually really great. And I will say Strange Loop, and I'll talk about it more when I get to the episode, I will say I've been very happy to see people in my life who were on the fence about seeing it, going to see it, and telling other people to go see it. There's an intrigue about that show this season that has made me very happy to see. People who in the past might have like ignored shows like Passing Strange because they thought to themselves, oh, that sounds like a tough sit, have brought themselves to go see Strange Loop because they regret the things they've missed in the past and sort of telling themselves now, like, I can't have these regrets anymore. I got to go see the thing. Maybe I won't like it, but what if I do? And they've all liked it. And it's been really nice to see that. Too little, too late. Who's to say? I think there are a lot of other questions in regards to Strange Loop's short run that also just has to do with the economics of Broadway today, as you said. And then we're seeing it also with new shows coming out this season, how they struggle and producers just completely not understanding what the market is right now and what is an appropriate ticket price.
Yeah, well, it's ticket prices, but also there's still this idea of like this invisible subscriber base of like, oh, well, we're gonna like try to, you know, look, you know, these are producers who are trying to, you know, pitch these, you know, these musicals to like middle American white women, you know. Happen to be middle-aged, who, yes, they purchased the most tickets, you know, but like it is a thing of like, if you build it, people will come. So if you, you know,
I've always said you need to first market it to New Yorkers. Make theater savvy New Yorkers go see it first. That we will buy up all the tickets, so when middle America's coming into town, like, what's hot? They're like, well, everyone in New York is seeing this show. That's what happened with Hamilton. Which we'll talk about with that episode and Chorus Line, like all these shows that became big hits. And we talked about it with the Rent episode. Like, it started with the off-Broadway scene with all of New York wanting to see it there, and then that power moving it to Broadway. So, you know, people will go see when everyone else is going to go see. It's why when people talk about, well, critics don't really matter anymore, they still do to an extent, because it's the same thing with like a Yelp review or anything. Like, you want to hear other takes from people who took the time to see it before you spend your own time and money on something. It's like, well, what did five other people say? And so then you look.
I mean, that's why we have rent heads. You know, that's why we have people who have spent their entire lives seeing like every iteration of
How fucking dare you say the dirtiest word of all time, Marcus? Rent head. How dare you? Anything else regarding The Strange of Passing, Marcus, that you wanted to cover?
I just think that closer inspection watching the recording of that Spike Lee so graciously gave the public, because I noticed that there is a musical motif that comes along, and it happens at every time they mention love. So if you follow it, I just think musically, I think it's a very, like, even though these are people who don't know musicals, mm-hmm. did their homework. So if you look at, I believe it's the Breaking Your Heart motif. If you follow that Into a Living Thing, that song. What is mm-hmm. that song?
Into a Living Thing. That?
Yeah. That follows an entire show.
Interesting. There's that there's that one motif towards the end that sounds like the Phantom Vamp as played by Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Do you know what I'm talking about? The do 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 do. I'm like, that's the Phantom Vamp. But it's because it's the bah, 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 but it's done like Mr. Rogers' piano. It's like do 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 do.
I never thought about that, but now I can't unhear it.
Now you can't unhear it.
Now I'm here, Dan.
There you go. This is what you come for. This is the magic you come for, Marcus.
You ruined Passing Straight
Through. How about that's what makes it so beautiful? You can hear that and still love it. If I had any advice for people who are interested in Passing Strange, I would say watch the movie first, because it is very much a show that should be experienced, and it is on YouTube, luckily. And yeah. Spike Lee did a phenomenal job capturing it. Also, it's because the cast album, unfortunately, is not the entire show. They try to just capture the big songs, and they do, but there's transitional stuff that's very important, and it just makes it very choppy, and it makes it very hard to follow. And this is a show that has no fucks to give when it comes to continuity of storytelling, of like what kind of narration they're doing, how they're gonna do it. Like, it's all free flowing, so the cast album doesn't really help with that respect. So I would say watch the movie if you can.
Yeah. Also, just like, I there's just certain things that they mess with that you can only really capture on stage. Like there's they talk about colorism, mm-hmm. you know, and just in very small, you know, ways, you know, just by having the cast be who they are. Also, this is like one of the very first Broadway shows that really like challenged how we see Black expression on stage. So you're seeing in the show, you know, you have characters playing church people. Then they leave that, they're playing punk rockers. Then they leave that, they go to, you know, to Amsterdam, and they're playing Europeans, and some of these Europeans are poets or artists or so forth and so on. Then you go to Berlin, and they're playing Germans. You're constantly seeing how, you know, you're looking at the global consciousness of Black people.
Mm-hmm.
Changes. It's never really been articulated or presented in such a manner since. And it really, I think in many ways it helped with the casting of not just with these actors, but how we cast people of color in stories. I mean, if you look at like Rebecca Naomi Jones's career in the year since, I mean, not only has she become like this goddess of rock musicals, because I think she's been every rock musical that you can think of since then. I mean, she was in, we mentioned earlier that she was in American Idiot. She did Hedwig. She did, you know.
She did Murder Ballad too. Yeah.
She did Murder Ballad. Yeah. She's just, she and she also, I think she did Tommy, like a concert. She's done so many different.
Probably.
She's just had a really become like the new queen of like rock musicals.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just look at Coleman Domingo's career and like the kind of characters he's been able to play since. Mm-hmm. Because he went from Passing Strange to one of my other favorite musicals, the Scottsboro Boys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's playing with Black stereotypes and that by playing, you know, Blackface characters. And so what it did, it really kind of opened up how Black expression can be seen on stage, mm-hmm. on the main stage. And so that will be its legacy.
Yeah, there's a joy and a fun that the cast has in this show that I love, because I feel when it comes to all repressed communities, you know, the queer community, the Jewish community, the Black community, like I feel like the ultimate revolt mm-hmm. is joy mm-hmm. and fun. you try to like bring me down, I'm gonna prove you wrong by like living the best kind of life. And so to watch that cast flip through different accents, different characters, and playing also different ethnicities, which is something that's never actually discussed, but like they're not always playing black characters. They exactly. just and they never address it either. You kind of just have to
just follow it
and through their own detailed work. But again, different ethnicities, different accents, different ages, different characters, different places. And they all get to have their serious moments, of course, but they also get to have so much fun and so much light. And it's such a release to do that. I think that's what makes that It's All Right Keys moment so palpable, is the release they all get to get from that. And oh, something else I wanted to say about Keys, which is why something that makes that moment so beautiful and powerful storytelling, and why it ends up being such a moment of joy on stage, is when Youth is given the keys from Ariana. She goes, yeah. "You get to here are my keys," and she just so nonchalantly gives him her keys. And something that just, and it's an image that Stu focuses on for the rest of like the next 6 or 7 minutes in two different parts. Keys, Mariana, keys, It's All Right. And some people might be like, "Yeah, keys. He's met her for 5 seconds. Why is that important?" It's like, no. That's the point. He's a black man who has never met this woman before, and she just inherently trusts him to give him her keys. Yeah. Where he's just come from a country where there's literally the line like, "Women lock up their car doors when he would sneeze, but she gave him her keys." It's something like that.
Yeah, like she's like, "Bitch, please." She gave me her
bitch,
keys.
Please. He gave me her keys. Yeah. And the exhale of, I can just be. And I can just be trusted, and I can walk down and not worry, and it's all right. I have her keys. Like, someone who doesn't know me just gave me her keys. And like, people who have seen me on the street my whole life will still clutch their purse when I walk by just because I'm listening to my Walkman. And there's that exhale is such a moment of independence and joy and revolution, and it makes it so. I don't know how to, bubbly, fiery, hot.
Well, it's one of my favorite moments is also like right around that time, right after that song, he is writing to Franklin, the pastor's son,
mm-hmm.
Europe, and he's saying that they told him how to wear his body, mm-hmm. and even if like it's ugly, to wear it like a gown. And throughout the entire show, even though he's putting on different facades and he's changing different ways of who he is, he's wearing himself, or wearing an identity, he's trying to wear those things as beautifully and as comfortably as he can. He's trying to keep that exhale. Also what this show does too, and you mentioned it earlier, is that there's an openness, there's a vulnerability, and like these are characters playing queer characters on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Which in these kind of spaces, usually you don't really get to see that in a musical. And We Just Had Sex is one of the most fun, perkiest number. It's like one of my favorite songs as well in the musical. It's a fun, effervescent, kind of opulent moment in the show. And even and they're talking about how they all, they're talking politics.
Talk about 10 or 15 different things before anyone brings up the fact that we just had sex.
Yeah. So, but like, and not only does the youth in the song, say that he's had a threesome with Renata, and I forgot who the other
person, Mariana,
but he's also had sex with, the men as well.
Yeah.
And it's so nonchalantly done, And
the line is, I love that how they're so nonchalant about the only thing I want. And yeah, the way that they portray that with the queer element of We Just Had Sex, it's the joke isn't, oh, isn't it funny he had sex with a man? But it's the surprise of it, how he's now starting to just embrace the fluidity of sexuality. And the way that Daniel Breaker plays it is like, it takes him by surprise as well. When the guy sits next to him, he goes, "We just had sex." Daniel Breaker's face is like, "I guess I did just do that. Huh. Okay."
It was nothing. Just like, it happened. Yeah.
Marcus, this has been delightful.
Lovely. I've had a great time. I hope that I sound better than I did last time.
Well, the Carolina Change episode is a chaotic episode because I had to intersperse solo recordings of you. This is just you straight through, Hanny. But I've had a great time. Whether either one of us has made sense to any of my listeners, I don't know. I don't care. We have a new game at the end of this series, and you can play or not if you want, but it's basically 6 degrees, and okay. It's the two titles are Who Lives, Who Dies, Janine Tesori. So you have to do 6 degrees of Janine Tesori with this show, and then the other one is 6 degrees of Sally Murphy. Now I am more than happy to take over Sally Murphy. There is a very quick Janine Tesori 6 degrees here.
I could do six. Yeah, we can do a Janine Tesori. I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wanna try that?
Okay. Well, so the only it has to be original company members. You can use creative teams as well. But yeah, so like if you're connecting to shows and actors, you can't be like, well, they replaced in such and such. I did cheat last time with Torch Song Trilogy, but I don't care. There is a 1 degree from the show with Janine Tesori.
Oh, well, okay. Who is it? Okay, now I'm trying to think. All right.
It's a performer. I will say it's a performer.
It's not Rebecca, right?
No.
Oh, Danny Breaker?
Mm-hmm.
He was in Shrek. Yeah.
He went right from this to Shrek, baby.
Oh, look, that's what it was.
He replaced Chester Gregory James.
That was really quick. Okay.
That was really quick. The next one is Sally Murphy. And you follow me on Instagram, so you know that I love her very dearly. I actually haven't thought of this one yet, so give me a second.
Okay. Now I'm trying to think of like,
Well, I mean, we could do Daniel Breaker did Shrek with Brian D'Arcy James, who was in Carousel with Sally Murphy, but I want to do something more fun than that. Let's do Rebecca Naomi Jones.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do Rebecca Naomi Jones. Rebecca was in Significant Other with Gideon Glick.
Yes.
That's 1 degree. Gideon Glick was in... Oh, you know what? Gideon Glick was in Spring Awakening with Lea Michele. That's 2. Lea Michele was in Fiddler on the Roof with Sally Murphy. That's 3! There we go! I did it! Marcus, what we're learning is that Sally Murphy should be afraid. Very afraid of me. This has been a lovely time. Marcus, where can people find you if you want them to find you?
Real Marcus Scott on IG or Instagram, as they call it, or Real Marcus Scott on Twitter. You can also check me out. I am doing a couple of things with Gingold Theatrics as a playwright. I have a play called There Goes the Neighborhood. It's a horror slasher. And I have a play that I'm developing called Joy Comes in the Morning with the Road Theater in LA.
Amazing stuff. If you want to follow me on social, I'm only on Instagram at Matt Koplik, usual spelling. If you like the podcast, give us a nice 5-star rating. You can even write us a review. I swear, I hope the sound is getting better. I'm trying my best. So if you give us a 5-star review, hopefully you don't have to talk about how the sound sucks. I apologize profusely about the low volume on Rent. I did ask a couple of listeners. I'm like, is it that bad? It's like, no, it's not that bad. It's just like, it's low and you get used to it. And then that ad comes in and you're like, Jesus Christ. So hopefully now that everyone knows, if you tell people about the podcast, just tell them the Rent episode is good. It's just the volume is off. But otherwise, we're doing our damnedest. Join us next week for who knows what, because we're doing this whole thing out of order. As you know, Marcus, we do close out every week with a Broadway diva. And you know who we have not closed out with yet is Miss Rock Musical God herself, Rebecca Naomi Jones. So I say we close out with her.
Let's sign up on it. Yeah.
So, Marcus, this has been lovely. Everyone, catch us next week. And yeah, that's it. Have a great week, everybody. And take us away, Rebecca. Bye.
Have you ever wondered how your favorite performer actually feels? Well, here's your chance. Welcome to The Quiet Part Out Loud with me, Bobby Steggert, Broadway actor and now a therapist to a whole host of Broadway creatives. Part interview, part therapy, this is not your typical podcast. We'll go right to the heart of things with some of your favorite artists. what they still struggle with, what lessons they've learned, what they haven't figured out yet. There's enormous power in saying the quiet part out loud. Are you listening?
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.